Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And we're here to talk about A Course in Miracles, as is most everybody in this room. And Bruce is suggesting, how about we talk about the Earth Day theme? What a great idea. Because, Earth Day really gives us a little bit of something to think about as being Course in Miracles students. Because as I was reading along with some of the comments people were making, saying, you know, the world is a wonderful world and other such stuff. And really, nah, it's not. if you think the world is a wonderful world, then, how do you explain your disappointments in your body, in your life, in your career, in your relationships, and your friends and your family, and just death in general, and life, the way that our lives are being not the holy lives that we'd like to live. There's a lot of reasons that it's not not really a wonderful world at all. And in fact, it really is just it is a diversion from our reality. But anyway, Bruce is suggesting we talk about Earth Day. And so he says, let us start with references to Earth in A Course in Miracles. And let's see, is this something you or somebody else put together? But I'm going to post it in the room so that people can go there and look at what we are. A Course in Miracles search. And let me go to that place my own self. And Bruce, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I didn't hear you breathing.
Oh, okay. No. I was just listening patiently.
Breathe louder.
And attentively.
All right.
So anyway, good morning, everyone. Thank you, Lynn.
Good morning. So I went to this link that you put for the search, but it just is a search. So we're searching for Earth.
Yeah, it came up with 72 references, and I just put an Earth in that Miracle Distribution Center search function. So, I thought that, I was listening to Bill Maher's comments last night, and I was thinking, well, yeah, it's nice to be caring, and his commentary was more about some of the folks like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and what's the fellow who has the airline? A lot of wealthy celebrities who think, oh, let's go colonize Mars, and his comment.
Oh, Richard Branson.
Richard Branson, thank you. Yes, yeah. Anyway, and it was like, how about taking care of this planet first? and I think actually it's sort of symbolic of, anywhere but here kind of thing, and yet not in my backyard kind of thing. It's the ego's conundrum of never being satisfied, but always wanting greener grass somewhere else kind of thing. But probably not too green a grass on Mars at present without a lot of fertilizer.
Right. But we could terraform it, and we could do that. We could build up the atmosphere and do all that. We could do those things.
Yeah. So. His humorous comment was, unless you want to, eat stuff grown in Matt Damon's poop, if you haven't seen The Martian, that joke lost in you, but anyway, I thought he had some good comments, and at the same time, it was reminding me how, what A Course in Miracles was suggesting is that this entire universe, let alone the Earth, is not only, as you were pointing out, Lynn, disappointing, at best, but really a dream. It's an illusion. And why would we, obviously, two questions on the level form. Why would we not care for it? It would be silly to not take care of our little piece of it and do whatever we can through our connections and activism and whatever else we feel motivated and inspired to do to make it a nicer, happier, more ecologically sound and sustainable place. That would be silly not to do that, right? But we're not talking about that here, primarily because this is a curriculum about mind. And if we're talking about the mind, then the Earth and everything, anything and everything involving space and time is part of a massive holographic projection that we keep moment to moment regurgitating from a tiny mad idea and investing, you know, breathing life into, to use a biblical phrase, you know, that we're investing our identity in something that on some deep level we all know isn't going to work out for us so well. You know, even if we ignore the obvious thing of, you know, just add a century to anybody's life, you know, duration, and things aren't as pretty, you know.
Exactly.
If you were to add 100 to anyone's age listening, they probably wouldn't be in as good a state, you know, at least biologically or physically. But the whole physical thing, including the Earth, was made as a distraction. It was, you know, the ontological guilt that the Course in Miracles talks about is really the impetus for having made up this thing in the first place. That's the outer shield of oblivion to hide, you know, the cosmos of space, time, matter, and energy, personas, bodies, form, all that stuff, was made to hide the intrinsically insane thought that we could fragment perfect oneness. And that's where the whole thought system of guilt, sin, fear, death, and that whole gamut of insanity arose from that one idea. And then as an escape mechanism, we made up a whole Earth, you know, and its entire cosmology to, you know, its tiny little place in that cosmos as a way to simultaneously make our egos big and everything else tiny, and yet recognizing, forgetting the fact that even on the level of form, it really is the opposite. You know, all it takes is a satellite photo from the early space program, looking back at the Earth, you realize, I can't even see, you know, the town I live in, let alone me on those photos, you know, because just, and that's just from, you know, in the cosmic perspective, the closest neighboring, you know, non-atmospheric vantage point that we can get. You know, we're not even talking outside the solar system, which is, you know, really in the same breath as a very local neighborhood cosmologically, right? So, but anyway, I think it's just a good reminder that yes, let's do what we can to be caring, and remember that it's the caring that's important, not the outcome of the caring, and you know, the compassion and the kindness and the love with which we embrace and address each interaction we have with any person, place, or thing here. And because it's a projection of our mind, we don't have to take it quite so seriously. Obviously, if there's something that, you know, the level of form demands immediate attention, it would be silly to not, you know, rush yourself or a friend to an emergency room if that was appropriate, or get involved in a march to encourage political change if that seems appropriate, you know, or whatever. But at the same time, if we can remember that all those things motivated by the spirit of inclusion and kindness and, you know, shared interest. You know, there's a comment I heard yesterday on TV. It's something about, you know, we're all in this together and it's all, you know, we all have the same goals and the same needs. And, just kind of a fleeting comment like that. You know, if you're listening for those, you'll hear it on TV. Anyway, I've been rambling quite a bit. How about your thoughts on Earth Day, Lynn, before we dive into our suggestions?
I think you're pretty much right on. The whole idea of, well, first off, something you were mentioning at the beginning was about going to Mars. And, I, you know, from an early age, or I guess, you know, when I was in college, was a member of a group, and you may have already also been a member of a group called the L5 Society. And the L5 Society, a big part of what their, thoughts were is that, there's a certain place in Earth's orbit where you could actually kind of park And in that place, then you could build space stations, et cetera, and be able to mobilize to move on to Mars or other, you know, other places, mine the asteroids. I mean, we had all kinds of ideas of what we could do if we had all that extra real estate to go through and to get raw materials from, and that excuse me, that we could sustain mankind forever just by going out to the stars. And you see that in all these movies, everybody's going out, you know, going out trying to sustain mankind. And, you know, now that I look at it from A Course in Miracles perspective, it's horrifying to imagine, oh, my gosh, yeah, we're not only going to, you know, be in misery here, we're going to go someplace else and make that place miserable, and we're going to continue to go on and on and on, because that we haven't learned the lesson in the first place that, you know, that, you know, I mean, we can be like vermin going across the universe, reproducing and making more and more, but the fact is that the more we make, the more there are, and you know that's the opposite of one.
Oh yeah, so. It's very much about fragmentation and all that kind of stuff. As you were talking about that, I was reminded of a cartoon I saw on Facebook and shared quite a few months ago now, I guess. But I think it was some animator from Eastern Europe, I think, put this thing together. It wasn't any words, but it didn't need them. It was this guy who basically, it was kind of like, you know, the quote unquote progress of man on Earth, and it showed this, you know, primitive type person walking along, and as he walks along, you kind of go through time, and he shoots animals and then you know takes their pelts and wraps it around himself, and essentially, you know, it's a kind of a loot, rape, and pillage kind of scenario. And eventually he ends up in these heavily polluted cities and, you know, clogged roadways. And, you know, and it's kind of a political commentary, but also an ecological one. You know, I think the whole premise of the idea of sustaining humankind, you know, again, we have to look at why would we want to do that? And I'm reminded of Ken Wapnick's brilliant comment is, you know, when you recognize that you're in a desert, the appropriate thing to do is to leave. but I think sometimes we think that we're going to make this dream into this oasis. But in essence, the dream turf that we've made up here ultimately can be nothing but desert. We can have little momentary blooms that appear. But if you look at, I'm also kind of, you know, trying to keep in perspective too, is when you look at when the desert blooms, it's a pretty fleeting event. And those little colorful blossoms not only don't last long, but they're kind of far and few between. And they don't really sustain a whole lot because they're not, you know, no, hardly anybody's there to notice them, for one thing. But, you know, it's just, anyway, it's just kind of an interesting thing to contemplate how many ways we try through level confusion to make the dream work for us. And we've got our, you know, I call it recovering dream repair technician hats on more often than we realize when we're, you know, looking at Earth as the be all end all. And yet the heaven that is addressed, which has nothing to do with any religious connotations necessarily, but I think A Course in Miracles would suggest that it's more of a state of mind where we have recognized that the earth as a dream, as a projection of the mind, by shifting our focus from the material to the mental, is never going to make us happy as a cause, and we've acknowledged the fact that it's always going to be an effect, and it's always going to be an effect of what choice of thought system. And I think ultimately, if we choose the thought system of kindness and peace and inclusion, then the earth begins to diminish in importance as an identity. And so we don't have to join an L5 society. I think I'd heard of that, but I wasn't a participant. But yeah, I think there's nothing wrong with wanting to you know, do anything to improve any part of the cosmos. It, you know, as we, you know, in our limited ways, you know, think of it or see it. But at the same time, I think the bigger question might be to ask ourselves, why? Why would we want to do that? And what would be the ultimate purpose for doing that? And if it's basically to take the little I self and propagate that throughout the dream, then that might be a questionable idea, you know? But I think the idea is to question the bigger unquestioned question, which is, you know, how did the impossible occur, you know? And if we can get a satisfactory answer, which isn't going to happen on the level of the ego's thought system, then we can, you know, we can remember that we do have a voice within us that is always gently whispering in our mind that, you know, there's a reality, heaven, if you will, that doesn't change, that isn't subject to the terrors and the fears of being a fragile made up creature on a planet that has a finite lifespan and is subject to everything from meteors and other external cataclysms to you know, hurricanes and earthquakes and fires and you know, what we call natural disasters or in a larger insult, acts of God to perfect oneness. Not that perfect oneness cares about how we insult that idea. But anyway, I'm rambling on again. But I thought, why don't I read one more thing from the first quote I found that has the word earth in it several times. And this is from chapter 30, The New Beginning, section 3, Beyond All Idols. And I'm just going to skip down to paragraph 9, which says, "Who knows the Father knows this light, for he is the eternal sky that holds it safe." And the capital H he there is the eternal sky that holds it safe, forever lifted up and anchored sure. Wow, that sounds like a rather trustable, unchanging awareness, doesn't it? Its perfect purity does not depend on whether it is seen on earth or not. The sky, you know, again, the metaphor for what doesn't change in the ever changing celestial mechanics of planets and stuff. The sky embraces it and softly holds it in its perfect place, which is as far from earth as earth from heaven. It is not the distance nor the time that keeps the star invisible to earth. But those who seek for idols cannot know the star is there. Yeah, and again, there's nothing wrong with idols, you know, and our special relationships with just, you know, countless myriads of things in space and time that we want to unconsciously define us, and then also to define our disappointments and our martyrdom and victimhood. You know, why would we want to do that? I mean, ultimately, if we can begin to slowly release our grip, our mind's grip on that identity and the strategies of wanting to, you know, keep our little piece, typically, you know, and if we're in our most magnanimous and altruistic moments, we might want to think, oh, well, how can we keep the earth, you know, healthy and functioning for everyone that lives on it, all species and all animal, mineral, vegetable, you know, inhabitants, of which I would include humans as animals because, you know, on the level of form, that's kind of how we act, you know. But on the level of mind, we have a different option that we usually don't consider, and that is that the earth and all of its reflections are just that. They're, but, you know, mirrors of choices we've made in the mind. And we can, rather than trying to make those mirrors work for us, because a mirror is never going to make us happy, but the identity that is reflected in that mirror will either bring us perfect peace if it's an eternal identity, or essentially no peace at all if we really look at it honestly. So anyway, hopefully that meandering discourse wasn't too disjointed there. Did you find anything, Lynn, that you want to read through the search or anything?
No, I just wanted to mention about what you were just saying. This particular paragraph in itself really points out to me what it is that is happening here or appears to be happening here. Because the only way that I could love and cherish anything that I see is to believe that it's outside of me.
Right.
And to believe that it is something that I'm seeing that is not what I am.
Yes.
And so
yes.
If I look out and I see, you know, the world and what do I see now? You know, a lot of people look at the world and think it's a piece of cake, you know, because it's a desert, a dessert. But, you know, but if you look at what it is that you see, and I don't care, you know, how positive your attitude is or how joyful as a person you are, how forgiving of a person as you are. You cannot, or most of us, you know, there was just somebody posted yesterday a video of a guy, of a person in some eastern country beheading a woman in the middle of the street because she had been, you know, done something that was against their rules. You know, when I look at that, do I say, I see heads a-rolling while people are strolling. They see the blood, they might slip a little. But I think to myself, what a wonderful world. You know, that's...
Thank you, Lynn. That's a wonderful juxtaposition. Not that we should make light of you know those kind of horrific and or tragic occurrences, you know, as the world would recount them, but to remember that you know ultimately we're not going to find peace coming to us from a dream, from an incredibly sophisticated movie that we made up and forgot that we were collectively manufacturing moment to moment at, you know, 10 to the 44th, you know, frames per second, give or take, using the Planck time constant, is it? You know, we don't see the flicker because it's a really fast film, in other words.
Yes.
The frame rate is really fast. According to modern physics, it's, you know, about 10 to the 44th times per second. So there's
not time. That's the thing that makes it work, is that time.
Is exactly it. Yeah. And why in truth would, I mean, this sounds almost crass and heartless, but why in truth would we lament the coming and going of any body if and only if we recognize that the spirit that animates ultimately all those things could never be touched or hurt or harmed or its innocence lost in any way.
Exactly.
And I think if and that's a hard thing to think when you're watching those news broadcasts and you see, you know, the raw emotion of people reacting to that and it's easy to get caught up in it, frankly. But, you know, but at the same time, I think there's a part of us that we can allow to and nurture by asking ourselves, you know, would I accuse myself of this? You know, when
yes.
When we look at stuff that's horrific and say, wow, this person is whoever, you know, is quote unquote the perpetuator of, you know, whatever we're seeing and the recipient, you know, the other participant or participants in either quote side unquote, again, alluding to duality, is basically calling out for love, instead of expressing it. And that is again a call for forgiving our own projections, and in some cases, you know, taking some kind of action in the world regardless of whether we do or don't do in the world, we still have the option of mindfully looking without condemnation.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
I think that's where our freedom really lies, and the freedom of all the people that our minds are connected to, which is everyone.
Exactly. And how do we get to that place where we can look at that without condemnation, and to recognize that each one of those persons appearing in their places, each one, each and every tree, each and every leaf, each and every dog, cat, person, everything here is just something playing out a part in a movie, in a scene.
Mm-hmm.
And the actual beings that, you know, appear to be behind and animating all of these things, there isn't anything. There is nothing there, because what we are is one thing. There are no beings. There is only one being, and that is what we are. And so that one being that we are, it can never be separated, never have a head that can be chopped off, or a knife that could chop a head off. I mean, it just doesn't happen, because those are all animated characters working in a script in a dream. And so this idea that, you know, what I am is somehow or the other can be affected by what appears to be, is like saying that the sky is affected by the cloud that passes in front of it. It has nothing to do with that. I just was on an airplane last week, and looking at the clouds from above, and, you know, seeing, oh wow, those clouds are obscuring my vision of the world.
How dare they?
And from the earth, you know, no one could have even seen there was an airplane flying over. So this is how obscured we are because of what? You know, nothing. If that airplane started to somehow fall from the sky, those clouds would not hold it up. It would definitely, of course, it wouldn't straight fall from the sky. People don't understand aerodynamics when they think an airplane would just fall, because an airplane will glide for for a long time before it actually, you know, after it loses power. Anyway, however, that's just an assurance to people who might think that airplanes will fall from the sky. But the fact is that the cloud is nothing. Yeah. And yet it appears to separate me from what is really there. The cloud of our being and our personality. Someone was asking about, you know, the personality and the who I am. You know, well, who I am is really nothing. You know, what this is really nothing. That whole description is a lie, because who I am can't be described and can't be, you know, given a name or even put into a picture. So all of this stuff that we're looking at, what is it? It is a projection of our thought system. And so this projection of my thought system is the earth, is the sky, is the stars, is the, you know, is all the things that appear to be outside of me. And the fact is that nothing is outside of me, and nothing is outside of God. And that's why, you know, all this, you know, bloody earth, the next paragraph that is on this list is talking about the bloody earth, and the holiest spots of all spots on earth is where the ancient hatred has become a present love. And, you know, let's go ahead and look at that from chapter 26, the transition.
Okay.
And it's paragraph 6. Well, 4, 5, 6, 7, it talks about it.
Did you say chapter 26?
Chapter 26, for they have come.
Okay.
Section 9, chapter 26. And, you know, what I've come to see personally is that there is no difference between the earth and me. There's no difference between my, the things that I have projected and me.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things are a part of my own mind that I am appear to be projecting out into a world. So the idea that all of it is there because of a tiny bad idea in which the Son of God forgot to laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the tiny mad idea is, can I have a place with green grass? Can I have a place with growing trees? And can I have babies? Can I be a father myself? It's the son's bid to become the father.
The authority, original authority problem, as the Course describes it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the original authority problem. So this whole thing of the earth is our child.
Yeah.
You know, this whole thing of the universe is our child, and we see it as our creation, and we love it, and we cling to it, and we believe that anybody who doesn't love it and take care of it is cursed. And, you know, we have all these judgments that are based on, you know, that this thing that I think that I am, that must be preserved and protected at all costs. And the fear is that if I let go and return my mind to the source where I, you know, was before all this madness started, that I would lose my toys. All my fun stuff would be gone. I wouldn't have, you know, Trump to complain about, and I would have, you know.
Well, that's a pretty dysfunctional toy, but I think there's a lot of people who play with that toy.
There's a lot of people that pro and con.
Exactly.
So this is what we're clinging on to. We're not clinging on to something that is exquisitely beautiful that must be preserved at all costs, because if you look at the mechanism and the working of anything in the universe, you see that the only way that it operates is by destruction. A seed fell to the ground and somehow it sprouted and it began to grow. It didn't begin to grow saying to the earth and the rocks and all the other trees nearby, hey, I'm going to grow over here. Is that okay with you? Oh, and by the way, I'm going to displace you, and I'm going to probably put out roots that are going to take your water away from you. And, you know, is that okay with you if I do that? Because, you know, I want us all to cohabitate. You know, that's not what happens. You know, you go to any forest and you see what really happens. You know, a tree starts coming up and it's in the roots of another tree. One of them will die. They have wars, tree wars, actually, underground with the roots. You know, they go up and they take over each other's space in the canopy, and therefore not enough light is getting to the things in the understory. And then they all start dying because they can't survive without their light. And, of course, you're taking away their water and their nutrients from their roots. It's all – the beauty of the jungle is – complete and total dog eat dog and destruction going on. You know, we see it and say, this is so wonderful. But if you looked at the actual mechanism by which it operates, just like a star, beautiful, beautiful, it is burning, burning, burning. There is nothing but destruction, creation, destruction, creation. That's what's happening with the earth. Destruction, creation all the time. We have just, as humans, have kind of accelerated that destruction part of the cycle through our actions and operations. And this is why we have things like Earth Day, which is coming up and saying, you know, well, we need to stop messing with stuff because, you know, the original destruction creation cycle of the Earth is being disrupted by our activities. So, you know, let's stop that and let it go back to something more natural. Is that something more natural? Is it more desirable? Is it better? Is something intrinsically good about, you know, just letting a forest grow without introducing, you know, whatever, you know, thing we would do? Not necessarily. You know, if I wanted to put up a home for wounded veterans, or if I wanted to put up an orphanage and bring, you know, children who've been mistreated from all over the world to be in this place, there's not very many people who are going to say, oh, don't cut down those trees. They're going to say, by all means, you know, build the veterans hospital. By all means, take care of the children. You know, we don't care about those trees. We don't care about that forest. Oh, let's cut up all those trees and let's plant wheat. Let's cut up all those trees and let's bring in a bunch of cattle and let them graze. Right. You know, you don't see the earth lovers running around going, oh, please don't do that. Although in some places they do, like in the rainforest where, mm-hmm. you know, the total destruction is, what is it doing? It is possibly causing me to suffer because it's destroying the ozone or it's destroying the atmosphere and my breathing is not going to be good or my water's not going to be good or, you know, it, seriously, humans are so, and I'm not including everyone, some of you are not, I know, okay, but most of us are so hypocritical about what we prefer and want, and, you know, by God, if I want to go to the store and buy a bunch of bananas, I could give a crap less whether or not, you know, you grew these banana trees with slave labor, you grew these banana trees on, you know, over the nursing home where my grandmother lives, you know, that, I mean.
But nowadays we probably care a lot more if they were raised organically without chemical fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides.
Exactly.
But we, you know, we don't extrapolate to, you know, all the infrastructure and the interrelated connections that might be behind. But again, I think what you're getting at, Lynn, is really, you know, useful idea, because it basically is suggesting that we look at the whole system as a whole. But to do that, we really have to get back to the mind, ultimately, because we can't really make sense out of, you know, a network that's so vast that our little human minds are not going to be able to wrap themselves around it, and certainly not make, you know, choices that are going to resolve the problems in the world. But we can certainly remove not our bodies but our minds from the identification, I think, by recognizing that it is a movie. And earlier I was flashing on, you know, the director's clapboard. I'm not sure if you pronounce it. Is it clapboard or clapboard? That, you know, you see oftentimes when they show the making of, the director's, special features and of DVD, for example. And then they'll show the little black clapboard that's got the date, scene, and take number, and director, camera. I found a little graphic online. I thought I'd put that on the post for this. And, it's got the little black and white diagonal stripes, and you clap it, and that sound is actually used to synchronize the video and the audio. If you have an audio team editing the soundtrack and a video team working on the special effects nowadays mostly and the all the other visual aspects of the film, that sound of that clap, you know, they can see visually when that thing hits, and that's when they hear a loud pop on the audio, and then they use that to synchronize the two media, right? But mm-hmm. That reminded me of you know, we forgot, we came in the middle of the movie, so to speak, so we didn't see in our mind the director's clapboard being snapped and making that sound. So, because we've been so enmeshed in it through how many lifetimes we can't even imagine, probably, that we think this is the real deal. We have forgotten that this is a massive production, because we didn't see that clapboard, you know, clicking shut to signal the beginning of the film and the beginning of the take, right? And it reminds me of a comment that Ken Wapnick made in one of his audios about the War of the Worlds. When it first came out, Orson Welles did, in his, you know, profound and powerful voice, read the story of the War of the Worlds, and it was done in such a way that it sounded like a news broadcast, and for that era, in a way that was very realistic. And there was a lot of people who thought that this was actually taking place because they missed the comment at the opening of that radio program that said, this is just a story, you know, don't be alarmed, this is just a story, you needn't be concerned or upset by what you're about to hear, because it's just a story, it's just made up. But they didn't hear that. So it's kind of like missing that director's clapboard scene in our minds. We have no reference because we've blotted that out. We're so far down the rabbit hole that we've blotted out any reference to the idea that this might possibly be a massive dream. And so we're like in a Matrix movie or a Truman Show or whatever your favorite virtual reality film is we're so wrapped up in it, we think this is the real deal. But I think when we practice mindfully looking at the upsets that we experience and the things on earth and in the world that aren't going right, and realizing those are actually forgiveness opportunities and opportunities to look at the mind and to get back to cause. You know, we don't necessarily see the clapboard happening, but we kind of get a hint that oh yeah, this is a movie, and I'm one of many participants. And like you said earlier in our conversation this morning, Lynn, if we see, I think it was a very important comment too, that if we see ourself as different than the other person or persons we're perceiving, that is what ties us into the movie. I don't think that's how you said it, but that reminded me of that idea that you know, if, as long as there's an other and a self, and we think that's important, then we're forgetting the shared interests we really have and the intrinsic unity that's behind that. And so anyway, yeah, good stuff.
I agree. And that is it. It's the whole idea of the other. It's a whole idea of else, mm-hmm. someone and something else. And, you know, what I found, it took a long, long, long time. In fact, it's really funny. This was back in probably 2008 or 2009, when I was really new, or maybe before that, when I was really new with, must have been about 2005, with the course. And I was, cause I started reading it at the end of 2003. I read The Disappearance of the Universe. And so I've been into it for about a year. And, I was talking to Aussie on the phone, and I was riding the bus back and forth to work at that time. And I said, you know, I'm practicing on not seeing differences. I'm practicing on, you know, looking at people and seeing them as the same. And she said, oh, you know, Lynn, that isn't going to work because, you know, you're needing, you know, there's a lot more to it than, you know, just pretending that they're not different. And, so, you know, I kind of said, well, okay, you know, but I still kind of tried it. But what I've come to realize now, you know, like, you know, what, you know, 15, 14 years later, or however long, is that, no, really it is. It is looking at others and seeing them the same.
Uh-huh.
But I could never have actually done that at the time because I had so much evidence that those others were outside of me and that they were different.
Mm-hmm.
And, you
we
know,
I hardly ever challenge that assumption, do we?
Right. You don't challenge that assumption at all. Because, you know, it's what your senses tell you. It's what everything tells you is that everyone is different from me and outside of me. So, you know, and it really took the nobody's outside of me part for me to come to recognize that, oh yeah, no, not everybody is exactly the same. Everybody is exactly the same. It's like, you know, the things that we think are so important that make us different, like our political attitudes or our gender or our, you know, whatever it is that we think, you know, it is that makes us special. That all of that is just like nothing. It's like dust, that is just, you know, kind of accumulated a little bit over the surface of what we are. And it can be easily, easily brushed away. I don't have to be that, what I think I am. And that was a big part of it for me too, is recognizing that I was not what I thought I was. I was not what I thought I was at all. I was, I thought that I was a person, a woman with a body, that I had children, that I was an engineer, that I, you know, loved the earth, that I worried about the future. You know, I thought all those things were me.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until I recognized that, no, that's not me, because, you know, I've changed. I wasn't always an engineer. I wasn't always a mother. You know, right now I'm not an engineer, even though I think that way too much and drive people nuts. But,
I can somehow relate to that, actually. having been one in a past life that wasn't that long ago.
Yeah. It's pretty funny. I know yesterday I was at the grocery store with my husband and I would move the cart up and set it someplace. And then I would go and, you know, get things and bring them back to the cart. And he said, why do you keep leaving the cart? And I said, well, once you move a piece of equipment into place, then it's best just to leave it there. And I thought, no, normal people push the cart with them wherever they go. That's the way normal people do. Only people who are worried, thinking about flow and process would think like this.
I can totally relate to that. I've done that kind of stuff too. It's like, especially if I see something and there's a bunch of people and I know that if I push my cart over there, it would take a lot longer. So I'll just leave the cart and, reach in where there's room without interrupting people, but not enough for me in a cart and do that kind of stuff. But that's that kind of mindset of, I have been a process improvement consultant. So I totally get that and know how easy it is to get wrapped up in thinking, oh, if I just fix the process in the world, whatever part of the world we're looking at, that's going to make, this alleged reality better. And why wouldn't we try to do that? Why not minimize the waste?
There's no reason why not. And we're here anyway. Might as well, do something while you're around. Mm-hmm. So yeah, make things better, but then recognizing that what my opinion about things are may not be your opinion. That's what I noticed with my husband. His opinion was not that we should leave the cart and go find it. His opinion was, why are you leaving this cart here? And so he would keep moving the cart every time. And it's like, I stay in a hotel room with Cheryl Kaplan. I love to do this. It's hilarious, but of course it's just really silly. She turns the toilet paper so that it's from the underside, and I turn the oversight. So we spend the whole time in the hotel room switching the toilet paper on each other because, I think it should be this way.
Oh my gosh. Well,
this is how my personal.
I think there's a new therapy for that, right? Isn't it? I'm joking, but yeah. But that's the trivia. I mean, it's no different than the people's front of Judea versus the Judean people's front. His only difference is the order of the words in their organization's name. But that's that kind of craziness that we get into because of the earth. Okay, how about if I read the FAQ that has the earth in it that I found?
Oh yeah, that's a great idea.
Okay, it's a fairly short one. So
okay, well, good.
It's number 1278 in the FAQs.
Let me come over and get the link.
Okay. I'll go ahead and read the question while you're doing that.
You posted the whole question in here for me. Thank you.
I did, yeah. So the synopsis up in the, where they list a few questions at a time before you jump down to the content, is what was God's role in the creation of nature, natural selection, the animal kingdom, etc.? This is, again, FAQ number 1278 from the frequently asked questions of facimoutreach.org, and you can look them up numerically or search from them. I normally go sequentially through them, and I've got a few to catch up because I've been skipping a little bit in the last few months reading these with you on Saturday mornings, but you can also search. So I searched for the word earth this morning and found this one. I thought,
this is good.
Pretty appropriate for Earth Day, yeah. Anyway, it starts out. The question is, number 1278, I have recently begun studying A Course in Miracles, and I absolutely love it. However, there's still always a but, right? Here's my issue. Here's why I don't love it. That's my words. I am also a recent graduate with a degree in evolutionary biology, and I am just wondering about the course's view on the evidence for evolution.
Did I just throw my life away?
Yeah, well, what was I thinking? No, you didn't say it. Did the God in A Course in Miracles also create non-human animals, and does he have a role in natural selection? Did he create the earth over 3 billion years ago? I know there is no such thing as time in the course, but how do we account for the numerous studies involving radiocarbon dating, all of which show that the elements of the earth's crust have been around for billions of years? If God created us all as perfect beings, why did nature, in quote, experiment, unquote, with so many other life forms and habitats before man came to inhabit the planet? What are the course's views on other scientific phenomena, such as the laws of gravity and motion? Well, this is actually one that I think probably didn't really plumb and fathom much when I first started reading the course some years ago, because I was more inspired by the poetic nature of the writing and the feeling behind it. But the non-dual metaphysics, until I read Gary's first book, was a lot of it escaped me. And one of the things that really didn't click until 10 years ago when I read Disappearance of the Universe was the idea that God, and I know I read it because I read the, you know, all three books cover to cover, you know, at least once or twice in, before reading Gary's books. And was the idea that, that God has nothing to do with duality or space or time or matter. And if that perfect oneness that, you know, is a whatever idea that I like perfect oneness and perfect innocence, perfect kindness, perfect peace, all those kind of things as sort of placeholders for something, obviously, we can't really put words to ultimately, but we try. And God is the usual placeholder that unfortunately has a lot of religious baggage. But if that principle, that that essence, were to have invested in duality, then we'd be sunk. It'd be all over because we wouldn't have any opportunity to return to it, because that would mean that there wasn't a perfection to go to return to. It wasn't a dream. This was real. And I think that's what we all try to do. And that's the whole idea of level of confusion is we keep thinking that if I can just fix this world, this earth, and make this earth be the way I want it to be, by golly, then I'll have pulled off, and we don't usually put it in these terms, the ultimate usurpation of the throne of God, of perfect oneness. I will have successfully dragged God under the bus, you know, put him to death, and and basically made a better reality than the perfect oneness that I've totally forgotten about. But that's essentially what we're doing every time we try to you know, make a dream work for us. And there's nothing, again, evil, sinful, or wicked about that. It's just silly to try to make this earth be the be-all, end-all for us when it's really, you know, another metaphor I like is draining the swamp. And in this case, the swamp is the whole planet. And right now I'm looking out at the Pacific Ocean. If I turn my head to the left here, it's a little overcast, but I can see it through the trees here. And I'm thinking, wow, this, you know, huge mass of water. What if we were to drain metaphorically the swamp of our mind? I think it's sort of like we keep thinking, well, there's an island out there somewhere that's the paradise, and if I just sail far enough, I'll find it. But I think what happens is the more we start looking at our mind, the more we realize that we start seeing the ocean opposite of what's happening ecologically right now. The level of the ocean in our mind begins to drain, you know, and the water level gets lower and lower. And we see every time we see, oh, well, maybe it's that island, we swim over to it or sail over to it, and we go, no, that's just a desert also. And I think we realized eventually we'd start to generalize, and it's like, no, the whole thing's a desert. We've covered it over with, you know, the ego's hopes for paradise. But every time we look carefully and honestly at what we see, it's just a desert. It's just a silly, desolate place that in our mind that we made up, that fortunately it's a dream, but we don't see that until we, you know, honestly and objectively, dispassionately look at all the actuality of the dream and realize that that's not the reality that we really want. So exactly. Do you want to read the answer now that I've digressed?
Sure. and I did also want to say here, this person who just graduated and has this degree in evolutionary biology, and, you know, we all study. We're all studying, you know, how did this happen? Where did this come from? You know, evolutionary biology is some way to try to describe how this occurred. But the reality of it is that we were before any biology. We were before any evolution. We have been since the very beginning, the tiny man idea. We have never not been a part of the evolution, so to say, of the tiny man idea. Also because there is no evolution. It all occurred at one time. And so what appears to us to be sequential, because of the frames of the movie moving, really happened all at once and is well over, you know, long ago. So just trying to remember that and keep that in mind, because otherwise you'll get emotionally involved convinced that somehow or the other there is something you can do. As long as I think there's something I can do to change the dream, then I'm just going to continue to rearrange the chairs on the deck chairs on the Titanic, mm-hmm. because it can't be done. And I have to say that was, for me, Bruce, reading The Disappearance of the Universe, and I had not read A Course in Miracles prior to that.
Oh, okay.
So reading The Disappearance of the Universe answered so many questions for me.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because the questions that I had was, God does these things and he's supposed to be good, but I would never do any of these things. This would be the absolute opposite of what I consider goodness. And so, you know, God made this earth and look at what a mess it is. You know, God made children to be born with handicaps. God made children to be born in Somalia and Sudan, where they're having a terrible drought and people are starving by the, you know, thousands. You know, I was pretty mad at God and had a pretty low esteem of God, because I thought, what kind of God is this?
Right.
How can I be a better person than him?
Yeah.
How can I be more loving than God? You know, I would never ever do these things. And so when I read The Disappearance of the Universe and recognized, oh my God, he had nothing to do with this.
Pun intended.
Yeah. Oh my God. He had nothing to do with this. This was not God's creation. This was not God's idea.
Yes.
God didn't make starving children. God didn't make cancer. God didn't make any, you know, going back to the early lessons, you know, lesson 14, God didn't make it so it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. If God didn't make it and it doesn't exist, then where did it come from? It comes from my mind and my thinking. Not me personally, Lynn, but me as the Son of God who is dreaming a dream. So this is all a dream that's being dreamed by one son about many situations, many personalities, it's all of us, what appears to be separate beings, but only coming from the one mind.
Uh-huh.
And so that has been to me the most important thing at this point, is now reconnecting with the one mind.
Yeah.
Reconnecting with my one true mind and letting go of the false that I have been so convinced of. And that includes my children, my grandchildren, my husband, my dogs, my home, Colorado. You know, I mean, I went to North Carolina. I had a wonderful experience last weekend. Who had that wonderful experience? You know, it wasn't the Holy Son of God, who is having a wonderful experience all the time, that doesn't need to go to some other state and be up on top of a mountain to have joy. You know, that these are all things that are, this is all my own fabrication. And so from being my own fabrication, now I have a place from which I can work to restore my mind to a truth where now I'm no longer convinced about your state, my state, the state of the earth. You know, I recognize if I just let it be, then, you know, why waste my time unless I want to? You know, unless I want to. I want to go clean up the park because it's, you know, been trashed, or, you know, I want to go, you know, clean up the ocean, or you know, whatever it is, I can do what I want to do because I enjoy it, but not because I believe that if I don't do it, everything will go to hell.
I'm laughing only because I'm thinking, well, my immediate task this morning is going to be to clean up my bathroom because we have house guests coming this afternoon. but it's the same principle, you know. The scope may be different, but it's all the same. Of thinking that if we, you know, take care of the form, that the content somehow is going to change in our minds. But you know, there's nothing wrong with taking care of the form. It's just that if we have expectation that that's going to change the content of our mind and the unconscious stuff that is keeping us in a hellish world, which we could call Earth or anything. And again, the Earth isn't the problem. It's not the molecules of space and time that appear to exist in space and time that are the problem. It's the mind's decision for wanting them to be important. And I think that's what this FAQ is probably about to address.
Okay, so anyway, so I'll go ahead and read the first paragraph of the answer. So the person is saying, if God created us all as perfect beings, why did nature experiment with so many other life forms and habitats before man came to inhabit the planet? What are the course's views on other scientific phenomena, such as the laws of gravity and motion? So they're asking about basically the laws of the universe, which are not the laws of God. Just remember that. Even the law of gravity is not a law of God. So it's not really a law at all. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the answer. The foundation of everything taught in A Course in Miracles is its view of reality as non-dualistic. Nothing finite or quantitative is real, which means that not only is time not real, but neither is the cosmos. Only the realm of God, which is perfect oneness, and the non-spatial extension of his being as spirit is real. Okay, this is it. The only thing that's real, the realm of God, which some people pronounce that word realm. I don't know, but realm. Only the realm of God, which is perfect oneness, and the non-spatial extension of his being as spirit is real. Therefore, in real realm, R-E-A-L-M,
mm-hmm. And reality.
Real are the same word, basically. Therefore, in the Course, there is no connection between God and the world, as there is in the traditional biblical view of God as creator and sustainer of the physical universe. There certainly appears to us to be a world with billions of forms of life and non-living kinds of things, and so Jesus addresses us as minds, believing in what is essentially illusory. On that level of discourse, he talks about the origin of the world as a thought in our minds, the thought of having an existence apart from totality and wholeness. So what the world is a belief, a thought that we can be separate from God. That's what the world is. Jesus refers to this as a tiny mad idea at which the Son of God remembered not to laugh. Because the mad idea was taken seriously, the world then originated as an attack on God. And that is from the workbook, the second section, What is the World? Importantly, however, it is never more than an idea that never leaves the mind that thought it. Despite appearances and our experiences of being bound by physical laws, and see lesson number 76, I'm under no laws but God's. The practice of A Course in Miracles, therefore, centers on our learning how to interact on a daily basis so as not to deny our experiences, but to use them as a means of restoring our minds to sane perception and then to their original unchanged state of oneness with God's being. So, again, the practice of A Course in Miracles centers on our learning how to interact on a daily basis so as not to deny our experiences, but to use them as a means of restoring our minds. This reflects the principle that the world is the witness to your state of mind, the outside picture of an inward condition. A lot of people think that Ken made up that term, outside picture of an inward condition. But actually, this was from A Course in Miracles. And also something that you said earlier, and I didn't see it in this list, but I'll find it, that Jesus actually says in the Course, or maybe it's in the Ur text or something, that the thing to do when you're in a desert is to just leave. You know, this is a desert, and the thing to do is just leave. So the world is an outside picture of an inward condition. And, you know, that was what happened with me, as I began to recognize that that was the truth. then when I would see these outside pictures, instead of saying, how could they do that? And why won't they change? Or, you know, can we fix this? Now the first place I go is inward. When I see something that disturbs me in the world, the first place I go is inward and ask myself, what is it that I want to see? Why is it that I am looking for this particular picture? And what is it that I want to see? As far as the woman being beheaded in the street, I wanted to see guilt. I wanted to see innocence. I wanted to see...
As being apart from each other, right?
As being apart from each other, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it reminds me of that Thich Nhat Hanh poem that Tara Brach reads, and it's called Call Me By My True Name, and it goes through everything. You know, I'm the frog swimming in the pond, and I'm the snake, you know, that sneaks up and eats the frog.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not apart and separate from each other. It's all one thing. So whenever I perceive something that appears to be one of the lines in the pirate, in the thing is that, you know, is a sea pirate that you know, had raped a little girl, and the little girl threw herself overboard, and he says, I am the pirate and I am the little girl. You know, I am, you know, that they are both trapped in their own thinking and, you know, do not know any other way. So for, you know, the pirate, he thinks that that's okay, but, you know, he can't love himself for doing that. For the little girl, she thinks, you know, my life is over and, you know, I might as well die. But these are all thoughts that are in my mind mm-hmm. whenever I look at anything. In the world, that, you know, I can either choose to see guilt, and I can choose to demand punishment. I can choose to see victims, and I can choose to judge perpetrators, villains. You know, I can choose all those things, and everything that comes up to me is that choice.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that comes up to me is that choice. So what we're saying here is that if we use the world as a witness to our state of mind and see it as an outside picture of an inward condition, then I begin to see the reasons that I want to see the things that I'm seeing and recognize that none of those are valid reasons. You know, to see someone as guilty, to condemn another. You know, there's a lot of times I'll just look at the news just so I can figure out who to blame.
Yeah, I think if we can recognize when we do that on conscious level and then catch ourselves and forgive ourselves and say, oh, wow, I was looking for another scapegoat again on through the whatever media we're consuming. And again, we think I kind of revealed a little Freudian thing there because, you know, consuming media sort of implies that that's something outside of us, but really we're just getting the results and the feedback of a choice in the mind that we made collectively together to make up an insane world, and we've forgotten that we, you know, each took our parts. Or literally what you're saying, Lynn, reminded me of the idea of screenwriters, you know, writing, you know, their plays, and when that's done, you know, the script is divvied up into each character's role, and they have their parts highlighted, you know, usually and I'm just picturing someone with a highlighter going through copies of the screenplay, but they each highlight their speaking parts in a different role and their action, of course. But we've forgotten that we've done that. We've forgotten that on some level, this is a dramatic performance of cosmic proportions, and the earth is just one stage on that theater. And, you know, we're just carrying out an incredibly elaborate holographic play. You know, this is, you know, this is high theater we're engaged in. And, but we forget that, don't we?
So we do forget that. And so if the minute I start believing that I am the character, then it becomes like a 3D reality to me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then we're back on the screen instead of in the audience watching it.
Yes, exactly. And you know, all I have to do is is step back and become the observer again. Step back and, you know, get above the battleground and look at it from a point of view that is, not afraid. I think that's the main thing, is if I'm reacting to it out of fear, then I become a part of it. If I react to it out of love, and not, again, there's, when I'm talking about love, I'm not talking about love that says, let me fix you, let me heal you, let me cure you, let me fix this situation, let me change things so that everything can be better for you. That's not love. It may seem like love because that is the codependent ego, the way that the ego likes to keep everything connected and everyone under its spell. But real love is looking at my brother and recognizing that he is not the character that he appears to be. It's that true charity that Jesus talks to us about in chapter 2, where it's, you know, looking at a brother and seeing him as being far, far beyond where he appears to be, seeing him as being the Christ, the true Holy Son of God. And if I can do that, then what happens, what occurs then, is I'm no longer then blaming the character for the script. No longer fearing the character because of the role that's written into the script. No longer in love with the character because of the role that's written into the script. I see that the idea of love that is written into the script is very codependent. And it's conditional, basically conditional. And so if I can look with the unconditional love that is what I truly am, and I'm not saying, you know, that's an easy thing to adopt because it goes against all of your, ego reasoning that says, you know, well, I can't love them because they're, another religion, or I can't love them because they, you know, are heroin addicts, or I can't love them because they're, the president of the United States who's corrupt, or I can't love them because, you know, all my reasons are the things that the ego has thrown up in order to, make that outside picture, appear to be, something I can control. Something conditional that I can control. But the fact is, I can't control it under any circumstance. You know, I can't, you know, seduce someone into actually loving me by any action or activity. I can't buy, affection or love.
Which also presupposes that love is possible in the context of the world too. which I think A Course in Miracles would suggest that it doesn't happen here. It happens in the mind, and it happens in a mind that has given up the pursuit of trying to find the peace, love, and joy, and those kind of qualities that we've just described in, you know, bowling terms, in a system that's intrinsically dualistic, which the earth is. So.
Yeah, exactly. You'll never find it there. It's not there. Because the only place it is here. And here is where there is no separation, there is no segregation, there is no me and you, us or them, that what, you know, may appear to be a you is just a broken part of myself that I need to, see for the reality of what it is in love. Because then, you know, as the ego is incapable of love, but spirit is totally capable of love.
And it's capable of nothing but love.
Nothing but love, exactly. Uh-huh. And so you shift, the paradigm shifts to where you're no longer looking at the world or anybody as your enemy or anything to fear. You only see it as something to love. And in that state of mind, you can walk in trust. You know, it's a beautiful way to be and to live.
Yeah.
So...
Should I read the last couple
of
paragraphs?
Yeah, go ahead, read the last.
Okay. Paragraph. Yeah, this is, again, from question 1278 in the FAQ, Frequently Asked Questions of Foundation for A Course in Miracles website, which is facimoutreach.org. And this question basically about biology and Earth and you know, and as just to preface it with another thought that might help, and it helps me when I remember that any investment in science or religion or any other ism or you know, ology or whatever that's based on duality is necessarily going to be propaganda for itself and essentially a lieutenant in duality's army, so to speak. And if we kind of can look at our investment in those things in our mind and just smile gently at those when we catch them and say, okay, no, not this time. I'm not going to let me, maybe I'll let it play out for, you know, a minute instead of an hour this time. But we catch it and we say, you know, this isn't working for me. And we just, you know, realize that investment, whether it's, you know, a science or a religion kind of thing, or, you know, any other schism or dualistic notion, just looking at it without condemnation doesn't necessarily mean you don't, you know, if you have a career, you don't say, oh, I'm going to trash my career and just go live in a cave or whatever. No, it's not suggesting that at all. It's just saying you have a challenge, no matter what you're doing, to be mindful. And I think that's what this paragraph's about to say, because I skimmed it a little bit. So it says, this view obviously presents many challenges for you with your interest in evolutionary biology. View being, I'll just read the last sentence from the previous paragraph. This reflects the principle that the world is, quote, the witness to your state of mind, the outside picture of an inward condition, which is from the introduction that leads into the Forgotten Song in chapter 21 in the text. And anyway, it goes on and says, but this would be true for anyone, regardless of profession or interests. To learn this course requires willingness to question every value that you hold. And that, there it is. I mean, anything we value is, we're basically saying that usually, you know, I think the idea of a value is based on there's a lack, and the lack is a dualistic concept. And that's where we're given this curriculum of forgiveness, to forgive our, what appear to be outside of us, and this perfectly mathematically fine-tuned, classroom that delivers to our awareness through this feedback mechanism of the world and of the earth and all the seeming events and circumstances and people and stuff in it, exactly what we need at every given moment to optimize our forgiveness process and return back to mindfulness. And so it's handed to us on a silver platter. So anyway, but it's not easy, but it's simple, but it's not easy. And then it says, the course is a gentle path, however, and focuses primarily on transforming our perception of ourselves, each other, and the world, so that we will gradually be able to let go of the terrible burdens of guilt, fear, and conflict that we carry with us all the time. And again, that's again referring to the ego carries that all the time, because that's the only thing it knows. But we can choose against the ego by choosing forgiveness. And that's what in the concluding sentence in this paragraph says, this is done through the practice of forgiveness, which directs our attention to the content in our minds that motivates us to relate in either helpful or hurtful ways. And then, you know, if we can see the motivation for those two thought systems and see the results, you know, that metaphorically Holy Spirit removes us from the world that is ultimately based on fragmentation, and the ego anchors us more deeply in it. So the choices become pretty clear the more we look at it and the more we generalize. Yeah. Any comments on that?
And it is interesting. Thank you for giving, you know, I didn't realize that this Course in Miracles Resource Center had this, a keyword search. This is awesome, and I'm really, really grateful for that. And I'll put the link in the room in case anybody wants to go themselves and look for stuff, because it's really, really a good thing here.
Yeah,
as opposed to, you know, a bad thing. Anyway.
Yeah. So in other words, that, you know, you're basically reiterating what I mentioned earlier, that I've been kind of mostly going through these, you know, numerically, chronologically, but you can use a search function in the FACIM Outreach website to search on a whole gamut, a whole huge range of different everyday stuff that people ask about and how it fits in with the course's metaphysics and how to apply it. And it's a very pragmatic, very practical body of insights that we've been sharing from for quite a few months now, huh?
Yeah, it's amazing. So this last paragraph, really what they're saying is whatever your profession, whatever it is that you're doing, it's okay to continue to do it. It's not like, you know, you need to switch your thing just because you just studied evolutionary biology and then you found out there's no such thing as evolution or biology.
There is no world. The central thought the course attempts to teach. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
sure.
Right, okay.
Remind me later. Yeah.
But I just spent, 12 years getting my PhD. I don't know. But
right.
But anyway, yeah. But what he's really saying is that, all you need to do is be willing to question every value that you hold. And so, being able to look at it and recognize, okay, it may not make sense at the time, but believe me, as you go, you absolutely do. It does make sense to you. He says that the course is a gentle path on transforming our perception of ourselves and each other and the world, so that we can let go of guilt, fear, and conflict. And, what the course also says, that the world itself and everything that we perceive in the illusion itself, the building blocks of it are guilt. Everything in this world is made out of guilt.
Mm-hmm.
So, then to be able to look at it and recognize, this is why, I can see, that this is made out of guilt. But I can also turn it over to the Holy Spirit, and the Holy Spirit will transform its meaning. And then whatever it is, if I'm an evolutionary biologist, or I'm a political pundit, or I'm an abortionist, or whatever it is that I tend to, that I do as a career, if I turn it over to the Holy Spirit and do whatever I do, ask for guidance and recognize that the script is written, so I'm not going to change anything that occurs. All I'm going to do is see things in a different way, and that seeing things truly is the gift. I mean, to see things truly without the illusion, without the blinders on, that is the gift, because when I see you truly, when I am able to join with my brother and see him as he truly is, which is the Christ, which is the Holy Son of God, if I see only the Christ whenever I look at you, whomever you may be, and if, you, whomever you may be, say or do something that annoys the ego personality of Lynn, I have a choice of either to listen to the ego personality of Lynn and be upset, or to listen to the Holy Spirit and to see that you are the Christ and to recognize that, I have no basis to have an opinion one way or the other about what you say or do, because it's like having an opinion one way or the other, whether I like this particular raindrop that fell on me, but I don't like this raindrop that fell on me. It's all the same thing. So,
You're a raindrop bigot, huh?
Yeah, I'm a raindrop bigot. So, this one hit me in the eye and I'm mad, but, this one landed on my arm and it's beautiful. That's how arbitrary our choices are about what we like or don't like in this world. It may seem more dramatic because it seems like some things are so terrible and other things are so beautiful. But in reality, none of it, has any meaning. Nothing I see here has any meaning. If I think it does, then I'm the one who gave all the meaning to it that it has. And I can ask, why did I give that meaning to that particular thing? I was listening to, I don't know, who was it, Byron Katie or somebody, the other day. I think it was a female. Maybe it was Anthony DeMello. It was Anthony DeMello. And he was saying, you can say, well, I'm a good person, I'm a loving mother, I love my child. And you can say, well, would you run into a burning building to save your child? Well, yes, of course I would. What about your neighbor's child? What about, you know, what about a child in Syria? You know, would you run in to save a child in Syria? Well, now we're coming into the differences that I'm making in my mind between what I think is mine and what I think is not. And if I don't think that that child in Syria is just as much my child as my child in the burning house, or, you know, my child who's, or my neighbor's child, or a stranger's child who's, you know, out in the street, you know, taking heroin, you know, if I see any of that any different than me, my own mind, my own need to love unconditionally that person, that being, and to do whatever I can to help them, you know, not be in fear and help them to feel loved and, you know, whatever I can do, which is not much as a human in the world, but as the Holy Spirit, it's everything. And so turning to that Holy Spirit that's in my mind and asking, you know, what can I do? What should be done? And the reality of it is the only thing I can do and the only thing that should be done is allowing my mind to be healed, because this healing, that gentle transformation that they're talking about here, actually is what heals the world and brings about the end of the world and the disappearance of the universe. Is through that forgiveness. So, you know, I don't, you know, I have my marching orders. I have my directions, and, nowhere in my directions does it say, you know, save this person, but don't save that person, or, you know, give to this charity, but not to that, or love this person, but not that. No, my directions are everybody is the same and love them all as they are the same. And treat them all as if they are the same and see the sameness in them, which is the truth of what they are, the Christ.
Yeah.
That's it.
Another exercise I found really helpful is to see, this is from Gary Renard's Fearless Love audio. It was the one phrase that really just, I mean, it was all really good, but one that just really stuck out for me as a wonderful exercise, and every once in a while I actually remember to do it, is to see all of spirit in each person you meet. Not just part of it, but to all of spirit. Because that means that the entire essence of the you know, you might want to use the term heaven as contrast with earth, if you will, is present and alive and, you know, and vital in every single part of what the Course would call the sonship, you know, that every person, place, or thing, throughout space and time is that totality, not just part of it, but is the totality. And, you know, the all in all, if you will. And I think that's kind of a good reminder that if we look at our assumptions about the world and particularly the earth and realize it's a dualistic system, you know, we can go past it if we remember to see that the intrinsic sameness that leads to the oneness. And just real quick, since we've got a couple of seconds left, I want to mention that if for people aren't aware of it, you can pre-order Gary Renard's new fourth book, which
I'm
is
so
going to be
excited.
About the lives of Jesus and Buddha. I just learned about that the other day and posted that on my ACM blog Facebook page, and I'm going to probably do a little. I'm going to see if I can get Gary in to do another video interview. Gary and Cindy, maybe they can give a few teasers on it. So I'm overdue for a recorded video conversation with them. So I'll see if they can squeeze that in their schedule, which I know is going to be very busy as all.
Yeah, and you know, it doesn't come out till November.
Right.
But
you can pre-order it on Amazon now. Yeah. So
yeah,
that's kind of fun.
Yeah.
It looks. I just the theme of it sounds wonderful. So
I know. I'm so excited. I think
because
you know, when I first looked at it, I thought, well, you know, how useful can that be? But then I looked at the description and I recognized, oh, so here we get to see something about, you know, how they interact. You know, I mean, this practical stuff
mm-hmm.
that can be used here, because you're Jesus and I'm Buddha. And if we aren't recognizing that at this moment and treating each other as if we were that,
mm-hmm.
then we're kind of missing the point, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, if we're all, each of us is all of spirit, then we can afford to not only laugh at the differences, not on the level of form, but on the level of mind, and then see the shared interest, and why not use two luminaries from our history that are examples of those who have devoted their lives to seeing that everyone is all of spirit, and that, and sharing the idea that we can all do that. Not, you know, these things I do, you too shall do and greater, you know, that kind of stuff. Because that's,
exactly.
I mean, but that's really, you know, in other words, the greater is not just, you know, a bigger and bigger division. You know, it's not saying, well, I'll incorporate into my thought system, you know, the Milky Way and Andromeda. But, you know, but those other galaxies are shit. You know, I'm not going to mess with them. You know, it's not that kind of thing. It's basically all inclusive. But we have to remember that each of us are that entirety. And the way to get to that, I think, is through our down in the trenches, you know, every day rubber meets the road forgiveness curriculum. So anyway, well, thank you, Lynn, as always, for inviting me to share this hour and a half or so with you, and look forward to the next one. And I'm reachable,
yeah,
as always, on
acimblog.com
and Facebook and all that kind of stuff. And I know you've got things like that as well out there.
Yeah. Exactly. And I will definitely send you this recording as soon as it is done saving, I say right now. I don't actually see Devin and Barb in the room yet.
But I think
I might just, you know, put on a song or something and hope that they come in,
okay,
so as not to make this recording any longer than it is.
All right.
So thank you so much, Bruce Rawls.
Thanks, Lynn, and all. Have a great week.
Have a great week, and we'll see you next Saturday.